I've never been in trouble in my life. I didn't even have a parking ticket. I didn't, you know what I mean? I was brought up like cops are the good guys.
I didn't know what was going to happen, but I do know that everything was stacked against me. Everything, like everything.
This isn't supposed to happen this way. I'm innocent. I know I'm innocent. I know I had nothing to do with this. How is this possible?
I grew up trusting the systems. I grew up believing that every human being should do the right thing. And that's why, even though I knew I was dealing with corrupt people, I was not going to bribe anyone to get me out of prison. Because I wouldn't live with the fact that I bribed my way out of my wife's death.
I'm not innocent until proven guilty. I'm guilty until I prove my innocence, and that's absolutely what happened to me.
Our system, since I've been out 10 years, it's come a little ways, but it's still broken.
I totally lost trust in humanity after what happened to me.
This is Wrongful Conviction.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me. And today we have an episode that I'm actually kind of intimidated to even do, because I'm interviewing a personal hero of mine, Damien Eccles. Damien, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it's extra special because we're here recording in front of an audience at the Church of Rock and Roll in Las Vegas, of which you have been an incredible part. And I'm so grateful to you for your participation. But I want to start this episode by apologizing to you on behalf of the entire human race for what is just an unbelievable, there's not a right word for it, but nightmare saga ordeal that never should have happened in the first place. And I just wanted to tell you up front that I'm inspired and just incredibly moved by your presence. And so with that being said, before I get all gushy here, let's get right into it. So I'm going to ask you questions. Some of them I already know the answer to because I'm familiar with your story, but not all the details. But let's go back to growing up, your childhood.
Okay.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I did. My family history is kind of odd and convoluted just because my mother and father were both married about five times each.
Wow.
So I have a lot of, half siblings, step siblings, full siblings. So my family tended to vary at any given time. It could be anything from just me and my sister to, I think like the most was like seven of us at one time, seven children at one time. So it was kind of all over the map.
And I've heard you talk about the fact that you grew up so poor that when you finally moved to a trailer, it was like you felt like you were like the Jeffersons moving on up, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, can you describe what did that look like? I mean, did you grow up in West Memphis?
Well, when I was really young, one of the things, whenever Lori was working with the investigators looking back over the case and they were getting like my school records and things like that, one of the investigators was saying, this can't be right. These school records show that sometimes you moved as often as every 2 weeks. And I did. You know, I lived in Arkansas, Texas, Tennessee, Mississippi, Louisiana, Maryland, Oregon, just everywhere. We were constantly moving. You know, my parents, or my dad at least, sort of thought, you know, maybe if we go to this place, then, you know, somehow or another we'll escape poverty. You know, there'll be a better job, a better place to live, a better something down the road. So we were constantly moving from place to place, looking for something better than what we had, trying to escape poverty, basically. But we would always, at the same time, end up coming back to either Tennessee or Arkansas, because that was where we had, you know, the most family members, at least some sense of support or community. So we went all over the place, but would always end up coming back there.
And for you growing up in this really, I mean, I didn't even know every 2 weeks, you were literally a nomad, mm-hmm. right? An American nomad.
Yeah.
And I've heard you talk about, I watched your moth presentation, which is wonderful. If anyone wants to go online and see it, it comes right up when you Google Damien Eccles. It's a 10-minute video that is very, very powerful. So you talked about how for you, and this is why it's so exciting and interesting to be here right now at the Church of Rock and Roll, you talked about how music and books were really your way of sort of taking yourself out of this really miserable situation in many ways that you were in.
Absolutely. You know, my family, I have a ninth grade education. I dropped out of school when I was in ninth grade, and that's more than anyone else in my family has. You know, if you look through my whole family tree, you won't find anyone with so much as a high school diploma. So we didn't have, you know, like a lot of books or a library or anything in our house. For me, I used to skip school and go hang out at the library all day, as odd as that sounds. I would hide in the library, read books, bring them home. Because when you're reading, you know, you're even if it's only in your head, you're going different places, seeing different things, having different experiences, and you don't have to focus on the fact that you're eating rice again for the, you know, seventh time this week.
And then you had a sort of an outsider. I mean, you were an outcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as partially as a result of that, or maybe it was a cause and effect, whatever, you ended up being inadvertently putting yourself in a situation where when one of the most terrible crimes, not only in the history of Arkansas, but in the history of America or the world happened, there were these very small-minded people around who sort of came to this instinctual, call it, conclusion that it must be the weird kid, right? It must mm-hmm. be the kid that wears black and listens to heavy metal, because this was in the, we're going back to 1993 now, right? May of 1993.
Right.
And many people will already know part of the story, but on that tragic day, three little eight-year-old boys went out for a bike ride and disappeared.
Right.
And they turned up sexually mutilated. One boy was castrated. They were tortured, hogtied. It hurts me just to say it. And their bodies were dumped in a swampy riverbed. So I know from decades of working on wrongful convictions that when you get a crime like this, especially in a small community, but anywhere, there's a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Nobody wants to have that pressure. Everybody wants to calm the community. And so the authorities are more prone to developing theories that in a more calm environment might not make sense and they might not pursue. But in this case, somehow or other, and this was during the Satanic Panic as well, right?
Yes.
Back then.
Yeah.
For those of you who are old enough to remember, in the early 90s, there was this very strange thing that was going on in America where there was these rumors of satanic cults and stuff like that. None of them turned out to be true, but that's beside the point. So what happened?
Well, for me, my entire life, the thing that has been most important to me that I love the most, that my life always sort of revolved around, was Western Hermeticism, ceremonial magic, all the way back from when I was a child. But I lived in an incredibly right-wing fundamentalist town where, I mean, there are places in this town where you come to a, you know, four-corner stop, and on all four corners of the street will be churches. If you weren't like...
That's like Starbucks now.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was like. It was churches were like Starbuckses there. And if you didn't belong to, you know, one of these mainstream, for that area, mainstream fundamentalist religions, you were automatically viewed as suspicious. You know, you were satanic. That's what they thought. And it didn't matter if you were a Buddhist or a Hindu or something like that. You're still satanic. You just don't know you're a Satanist. You're just being, you know, tricked by the devil into thinking there's some other religion. But then whenever you start, you know, bringing factors in like the fact that I actually did love ceremonial magic, and that's been one of their things that, you know, they harp on forever, that is Satanism, that those two things, there's no difference in those. So that was a huge part of what made them focus on me as well. You know, that was what they thought made me a freak. They think automatically you're a Satanist. It would take a Satanist to commit a crime like this, stick all those things together, and they didn't even look for anybody or anything else.
No, and they ignored, in this case, what's really stomach churning, aside from so many other factors, but one of the things that's really so upsetting is the idea that they ignored obvious signs
yep.
that pointed to at least one, arguably up to three other individuals.
Yes.
Including, and this is just, it's too strange to even believe, but the fact is that there was a local restaurant. Was it a Bojangles or something?
Yes, that's right. What it was.
It was a Bojangles where the manager called the cops that night and said there was a guy covered in mud and blood that stumbled into the fast food place and went into the bathroom. And to their credit, the manager called up and a police officer came but didn't investigate. And they ultimately collected evidence from that bathroom that he went into, which there was blood all over the place and mud, and they lost it.
Yes.
Right, they lost it. So,
I mean, not only that, but also even after they did DNA testing, you know, years later, they do DNA testing, find out that the DNA does not match me or the other two guys they had convicted. To this day, they still have not run that DNA through CODIS to see who it matches. They refuse to do that.
Yeah, which is so strange. I talk about it on the show a lot because in a case like this, especially in a small community, the people who are doing the investigating live in that community by definition. They may bring in outside experts, but a lot of them live in the community. And, you know, as a dad myself, or as a citizen, as anybody, everyone's got relatives. Everyone should be concerned for their own safety. When you have somebody out there who's capable of this sort of pure evil, you would think if for no other reason than purely selfish reasons, you would want to get that person off the street.
Yep.
Because that's a really scary situation. So, but that's not what happened. And it happens too frequently that these various factors combine to result in a tragic outcome, two tragic outcomes. Well, in this case, many, because there were three of you, all your family members are affected. And then the fact that the actual perpetrators were allowed to remain free.
Yes.
And there again were obvious signs. I mean, the one I just talked about, the various signs pointing to the stepfather of one of the boys, including a bloody knife that had the kid's blood on him that was found that belonged to him. I mean, this one kind of came with instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it's difficult, and I have, you know, I'm one of these people that I'm not an anarchist. I believe we do need a system of law and order. And I think there are a lot of very good police and judges and prosecutors out there. But in this case, you ran into the perfect storm. It's a small town, high profile crime, complicated crime, because the crime scene itself was a muddy riverbed, not the easiest place to collect evidence. It seemed to have been scrubbed to some degree. And then all the pressure.
And what people don't realize also, you know, just most people's knowledge of the legal system comes from watching TV, which is complete and absolute fiction. They don't, you know, it fosters this idea that these people, these judges, these prosecutors, these attorney generals, that they have these positions because they're somehow moral people. They're good people who are looking out for society. In actual fact, these are politicians, just like senators, just like congressmen. Their number one priority is winning that next election. So they're going to do...
Or that next case.
Exactly. Whatever the community is pressuring them to do, that's the way they're going to lean because they want to win the next election.
So, in this case, they focused on you, and then they had to find a way to get to you,
yes.
Right? Because there was no evidence connecting you to it. Did you know the boys?
No. Never even heard of them.
Even in a small, I mean, it's got to be a very small community. I would think that everybody would almost know everybody. Of course, I'm from New York, so I sound ridiculous. But you know what I mean? It sounds really small to me, West Memphis, Arkansas.
I mean, but keep in mind, these are 8-year-old kids. You know, it's an entire different generation than me or the other two guys even convicted were. There were, you know, no reason that we would know them. They were in elementary school. We were already, you know, in junior high, getting ready to go into high school. They also lived in, you know, the suburbs and the next town over. Technically, we didn't even live in the same town. They lived in West Memphis. Me and the other two guys lived in the next town over, which was called Marion. So, you know, it wasn't like there was any reason for us to ever even come in contact with each other.
And Jason Baldwin, let's just talk about Jason for a second because he's one of my favorite people. I called him before the best Jason I know. And he's been on the show. It was an awesome experience interviewing him and just an amazing guy. He just recently got somebody off of death row. I saw on Instagram today, actually, that he helped to free a guy from death row, which is such an incredible accomplishment with his organization. So Jason was your sort of your one and best and pretty much only friend at the time,
exactly.
Right? And he was, from just appearances, physical appearances, he was sort of, he didn't have the same stigma that you did, right? He was right. Sort of just an average looking kid, very, very young looking.
Yeah.
Must have weighed 100 pounds or less.
Yep.
Long blonde hair. Didn't look like a killer.
Right.
But to them, you did.
Exactly.
And he got caught up in all of this too.
Yep, just because he knew me.
Right. Unbelievable. So they found a way. And that way was Jesse Miskelly.
Exactly.
So from your view, and I want to know the moment, like I know when the cops came to your door and your life turned into the living nightmare that I think is everyone's primal fear. So they originally went after Jesse. And they sort of tricked him into confessing, and he immediately recanted after he confessed. But he was he was slow, right?
He had an IQ of somewhere between 70 and 72, and they interrogated him. I can't remember exactly how many hours it was. It was something like between 12 and 14 hours. And they're telling this guy who, you know, has an IQ that's way, way below normal. They're telling him things like, you know, just tell us what we want to know and we'll let you go home. So they finally get this guy to confess, and he can't get anything about the crime scene right because he wasn't actually there. So he didn't know anything. So they didn't care. The only thing they cared about was the fact that they got him to say yes. And most people, you know, on a jury, even today, they'll say, well, nobody would confess to something they haven't actually done. We know now that that's not true. You know, all the studies show that something like over half of the people who are falsely convicted end up being forced into confessions in one way or another. And this guy was just another person that got forced into a confession.
And we also know, Damien, that the people who are most susceptible to this are adolescents.
Yes.
We now know that the human brain isn't fully formed until you're 25. But when he was 16, right? And he was 16 or 17.
Yes, 17.
17, and with this low IQ, he was totally outmatched, overwhelmed, and probably after 12 to 14 hours, he would have confessed to, you know,
anything,
killing Abraham Lincoln.
Exactly.
I mean, just to go home, because that tiny room and the, you know, and everybody being on top of you, you know, it's not a situation anyone ever wants to find themselves in. And we know now from study after study that people will say and do almost anything to get themselves out of there. So, and he kept changing his story. It didn't make any sense, but it was good enough for them.
Yep.
And then he got them to do exactly what they brought him in there for. And he was just collateral damage. They didn't really care about convicting him, but they had to because he had now confessed. And in order to get you and to make his confession make even a modicum of sense, they had to bring him along for this terrible ride as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so he implicated you and Jason. And then they said, okay, now we can proceed. And then one night it was, I guess, right? You were home with Jason?
Yeah.
Watching movies?
Yeah. Me, Jason, my younger sister, and my girlfriend at the time were just at home watching TV. You know, by this time, we had been harassed by the cops for probably a month straight. They were at our house, either my house or Jason's house, or stopping us on the street, you know, just messing with us nonstop. Every single day. So when they showed up this night, we figured it was just more of the same. You know, we thought they're just here to harass us again. We didn't realize they were coming to arrest us this time.
So take us through that, because it's so terrifying. But
you know, like I said, we were sitting there watching TV, and they start banging on the door. You know, they're just beating the hell out of it like they're going to knock it in. And at first, you know, I'd said, don't even answer the door. Just let them stand out there and beat on it. But they didn't go away this time. So we go open the door immediately. You know, whenever I open the door, it looked like pretty much every cop in West Memphis is standing there with their guns pointed at me. They rush into the house, start destroying everything. They put me and Jason both in handcuffs, throw us in the backs of cop cars, drive us to jail. They immediately separated us. I wouldn't see Jason again for years. Well, I saw him for a short period of time at the trial, but we weren't allowed to communicate in any way whatsoever. You know, even though we're sitting at the same table, they've got me at one side and him at the other, and they will not even let us talk to each other. So we wouldn't, you know, talk to each other again for almost 20 years, I think. Okay, here's another thing. My brain goes dead a lot. I will forget what I'm talking about because, like you were just saying, people's minds are still forming all the way up until they're 25 years old. I was arrested when I was 19, and I spent almost a decade in solitary confinement. So I lost a lot of things that people take for granted, like face recognition, voice recognition. I have almost no short-term memory whatsoever. I will a lot of times forget what the hell I'm saying right in the middle of a sentence. Whenever I'm doing talks, I'll tell the audience that beforehand. I'll say, if I forget what I'm saying, I'll have to ask, and you'll have to remind me what the hell I was even just talking about. The reason I'm telling you this now is because I just forgot what we're talking about.
No problem. I can bring you back. And I know you mentioned to me weeks ago when we were talking about doing this event that was the case, and that actually there's a study being conducted at Columbia University about the effects of long-term solitary confinement on the brain. Because for you, yeah, you didn't really need those functions.
Exactly.
When you were in solitary staring at four walls all day long. With no contact.
Well, it takes huge tolls on you in many ways. You know, it almost cost me my eyesight because you're in this small space. And out here, your eyes are constantly changing focus. You know, you're looking at stuff far away, stuff close up. You're looking at all different colors. I didn't do that for 20 years. So I started losing my eyesight over time. I was in the hospital for a day 2 weeks ago because my lungs are so screwed up from breathing in years of tear gas that I have lots of attacks of bronchitis. It has screwed me up so bad that like 2 weeks ago, I walked into a diner, ordered some food, passed out on the floor. I come to, the waiters are around me. They're saying, are you okay? Do we need to call 911? I'm like, no, just give me a minute. Let me sit here. Next thing I know, you know, they've called the ambulance because I passed out again. I didn't even realize it. So it takes a toll on you in huge ways that last for the rest of your life. You know, there's no way for me to physically rectify the things that they did to me.
No, and we want to get into that too, because the way you were treated, even had you been guilty of this horrendous crime that you were in fact innocent of, there's no excuse or justification for the torture that was inflicted upon you. It's, you know, it just shocks my conscience, and I think it should shock everyone's. So you were thrown in the back of the cop car, brought to the police station.
Okay. When we're at the police station, I don't know what they did with Jason. They carried him off somewhere, and like I said, I wouldn't see him again for almost a year. They put me in a cell that was about the size of a phone booth. It's not what you see on TV when you think of a prison cell. You know, there's no bed, there's no toilet, there's no sink, there was no anything. It was literally a cell that there was just enough room to stand in.
Could you even sit down?
Nope. No. I mean, maybe you could, you know, sit like Indian style on the floor if you wanted to, but
it was literally a phone booth. I've seen those.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They left me standing there all night long. The only thing, every so often, one of the cops would come in and say, are you ready to make your confession yet? I would just stand there and look at them. They would leave. I stood there all night long until the next day. They got me and took me into a courtroom and told me I was being charged with, well, first whenever they take me into the courtroom, they tell me, you know, somebody's already confessed to this crime. They've implicated you. They're saying you were the ringleader of this. So now what you need to do is confess to this and say, no, you weren't the ringleader. They were. Try to put the blame back on them or you're going to die because of this. I can't even figure out who the hell they're talking about because, like I said, I've only got one friend in the entire world, and that was Jason Baldwin. I knew it wasn't him because he was with me and I knew he didn't do it. I knew he wasn't going to confess to something he hadn't done. So I didn't realize who it even was that had confessed until the next day whenever they take me into the courtroom. They say who it is and they ask, you know, how do you plead, all this sort of thing. They refuse to even read the confession in the courtroom. They ask me, did I want it read? I said yes, and they wouldn't read it even after they asked me and I said yes. Instead, they take me out of the courtroom into a janitor's closet with mops and brooms. They give me a transcript, a typed transcript of this confession. When I started reading it, it's immediately obvious why they didn't want this thing read in court. It made no sense whatsoever. You know, you're talking about this story that's like a Frankenstein patchwork thing that they've sewed together out of many statements made by somebody with an IQ of between 70 and 72. And what they would do is when he would confess to something and wouldn't get anything right, they would come back into the room and say, well, do you think maybe this could have happened? Or even more blatantly obvious, the first time they ask him, when did the murders happen? And he says something like 8 o'clock in the morning. Well, they knew that wasn't true because all three of the kids were in school. So they come back later and they're like, well, do you think it could have been a little later in the day? Like, when was it? Was it around like lunch or was it around dinner? And he'll say, yeah, it was around dinner. Well, they still knew that wasn't true because the kids hadn't even disappeared yet. So then they would come back and say, well, you know, when it happened, when you did this, was it getting dark outside? And he'll say, yeah, it was getting dark outside. Well, at that time of year, you know, it's not getting dark till like 8 or 9 o'clock at night in that part of the country. So gradually what they did was shape this thing to make it what they wanted it to be. That's why they didn't want it read in court. I read this thing. They put me in another cell where I would stay for almost the next year while I waited to go to trial. When we do go to trial, the evidence that they present us against us is things like Stephen King books, the fact that we owned Metallica t-shirts and albums, posters that were hanging on our walls, you know, things that were from like skateboarding magazines, ceremonial magic books. This is the evidence they had. The prosecutors tell the jury that these things are not only evidence that that we're guilty, but they're evidence that I don't even have a soul. That this is how evil I am. They came back in. I think our trial lasted slightly under a month, something like that. They came back in. They sentenced me to death 3 times. They sentenced me to die by lethal injection 3 times. They sentenced Jason to life in prison without parole. The other guy, they sentenced to life plus 40 years. They immediately take me to the court from the courtroom to death row, where I would not see Jason again. I saw him maybe 12, 15 years later for maybe 20 to 30 seconds. They used to bring other prisoners in to clean the barracks, and he was one of the prisoners they brought in one day to clean death row. So he comes by my cell mopping and sweeping. That was the first contact I'd had with him in like 15 years by that point.
Damon, Jason talked about when he was on the podcast how the first day in prison, he was released into the general population. And basically the entire weekend, he said pretty much everybody in the prison took turns beating him up. He was certainly in no position to defend himself, but he did the best he could. But obviously he had no chance. He's also just a very small, slight guy. I mean, he's not playing linebacker anywhere. You know what I mean? As I said, he was almost 100 pounds when this started and probably barely over it by the time you were convicted a year later. But for you, you were taken to the worst part of one of the worst prisons. You were taken to the hole of holes, really, right? As I heard you describe it, it was the darkest, deepest, smallest, filthiest place in the prison.
My situation was different from Jason's in that, like, he describes how they put him in general population. He spends, you know, I don't even know how long fighting, sustaining all sorts of physical damage, skull fractures, broken collarbones. At one point, he was hit in the face with a padlock, and it messed his nose up so bad that it bled for like a year afterwards on and off. Finally, when he did see a doctor, they realized what it was is that his nose had been shattered and one of the bone shards was sticking out. Oh. And they had to go in and pull the bone shard out of his nose and cauterize it shut. For me, it was the guards. Death row is different from the rest of the prison just because everybody on death row has a common enemy. You know, everyone knows that these people are trying to murder you on a daily basis. You don't have time to squabble with each other because you're too busy fighting to survive against the system. So for me,
meaning the guards.
Exactly. Every time my life was in danger, it was always prison guards. So whenever I first get there, they decided they're just going to welcome me to the neighborhood. You know, it's nothing personal. They take me to the hole and spent the next 18 days beating the hell out of me, starving me, pretty much doing everything they could possibly think of to torture a human being to me. The only reason they didn't kill me, and I do believe they planned on murdering me back there. The only reason they didn't kill me was because there was a deacon from the Catholic Church that used to come into the prison and bring communion to inmates on death row. So sometimes the sewage would overflow and you would end up, you know, spending a couple days standing in like ankle deep raw sewage. Well, the guards aren't going to clean that up. When that happens, they bring other prisoners in to clean it up. So they bring these other guys in from population. They see what the guards are doing to me and go to this deacon from the Catholic Church that's coming in. And they told him, they're killing this guy back there. They're beating him to death every day. This guy goes to the warden and says, I know what you're doing. And if it doesn't stop, I'm going to start telling people. I'm going to go public with it. That's the only thing they care about. You know, the only concern they have whatsoever is that people in the outside world will find out what they're doing inside those walls. So they took me out of the hole after about 18 days and put me back in a regular cell on death row. If not for that guy and those inmates coming in to clean up the sewage, I probably would have not have even lived the first year that I was in prison.
Doesn't sound like you would have lived the first month under those circumstances, but you did. There's so many twists and turns, and it's really remarkable the fact that, you know, so many incredible people got involved. The filmmakers, various celebrities, including Eddie Vedder, Natalie Maines, Johnny Depp. You actually look a little like Johnny, by the way. I don't know if anybody told you that. But anyway.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah. So so many people got involved because it was so obvious that this was such a terrible miscarriage of justice. And because it was the crime itself was so unimaginable, right? And I think that drew attention to it. And then the result was so obviously wrong that it made for, let's face it, I mean, media is important in these things. And in this case, the movies, was it the movies that started it? I want to talk about how you survived, and I know you're going to lead us in a meditation afterwards, which I'm really looking forward to, because if I can find 1% of what you've got through that meditation, it'll make my life better. So what was the tipping point that started to get people interested? Because here you are, like, just a guy from the middle of nowhere, convicted of the most notorious crime in the history of Arkansas. The odds of you ever seeing daylight again were extremely slim. The odds of you dying in a prison cell or in an electric chair were extremely high. What happened?
The only thing that saved me was, you know, really quite frankly, the vanity of the politicians that were involved. They allowed cameras in the courtroom. They thought, you know, this was going to be a slam dunk thing. Nobody's going to question this. They're going to send Jason off to prison, murder me, sweep this under the rug. They're all going to go out like heroes and everything's going to be fine. So they let these cameras in the courtroom, HBO, two guys named Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky. They come in, set cameras up, and film the entire trial from beginning to end. That footage would eventually become a documentary, a series of documentaries. But the first one came out in, I think it was 1996. It was called Paradise Lost, and it aired on HBO. If not for that, we would still be in prison right now, or I'd probably be dead right now.
Yeah.
People started to see the documentaries, you know, all over the country, and then eventually all over the world. You know, these things went all over the world. People would see them, and people started getting involved in the case. You know, everything from, really, people would do bake cakes and have like cake sales to raise monies, to raise money for, to pay for, like, you know, lawyers, private investigators, whatever it was. Because most people also don't comprehend the amount of money it takes to fight a legal case. I was in for 18 years and 76 days. Over that time, it cost us about $5 million to fight this case. Because, you know, even things like DNA testing, when you think of DNA testing and you watch it on TV, it's always the state doing it. You know, they didn't do anything in our case. We had to raise the money to pay for DNA testing ourselves, which in and of itself ended up being close to $500,000.
Right. And now the good news is it's become much more affordable. DNA tests can now be done for thousands of dollars, not hundreds of thousands, not tens of thousands, just thousands of dollars. And I do want to, I'm glad you pointed that out, because it's important to recognize the role that the general public played in this, right? It wasn't just celebrities.
Exactly.
It wasn't just filmmakers. There were people, I think it's fair to say, all over the world,
yes,
who saw this movie, and it's so painful to watch. And now we have the modern day equivalent with Making a Murderer and Brendan Dassey, I guess you could say, right? Except he wasn't sentenced to death. But when you watch Brendan Dassey, you know, his interrogation, you can get a sense of what the Jesse Miskelly interrogation must have been like. And a couple of things that I want to mention about his false confession. One is that he recanted it immediately after he gave it, but nobody cared. The other thing is that they interrogated him for, as you said, 12 to 14 hours, but they only recorded a half an hour of it.
Exactly.
Right? So what does that tell you? I mean, it's really, apparently they didn't want a recording of them telling him all the information that he didn't know since he wasn't there. That would have been inconvenient, exactly. So to say the least. So there you are, and I guess you're kind of getting these little rays of hope while you're in the most hopeless situation that anyone can be in, right? Are you aware at this time of everything that's going on? This, and how important was it to you when people would write letters? Because it's one of the things I tell people when they ask me, what can I do? I'm just a regular person. I don't have any access. I don't have any influence, whatever. I'll tell people, go to the website. Go to innocenceproject.org. Go to your local Innocence Project. There's Innocence Projects all over the country. Write letters. Talk to people. Write letters to journalists. But also, I mean, you must have been getting a lot of mail at this time. And how important was that? Because I talk about writing letters to people who are on the inside as being, you know, one thing that almost anybody can do.
Exactly. You know, and it really does help because it gives people inside something to focus on other than prison, other than, you know, the walls you're trapped in 24 hours a day, other than the brutality, other than the deprivation and degradation and everything else. It gives you something to think about other than all of that stuff going on, which really does preserve your sanity. So even just doing something as simple as writing a letter to someone in prison really does change their life in a very marked, profound way. For me, you know, this was, I still haven't seen the documentaries. I don't watch stuff like that. So the only way that I would really know that it was that things were changing, that things were happening, one is the mail gradually started to change. It went from in the very beginning getting, you know, there was a trickle of letters started right after the documentaries come out. Like you would get 3-5 letters a week. It built up to, by the time I got out, the people in the mailroom at the prison hated me because they would come to my cell with like big plastic, you know, mail crates full of mail, and they would have to stand there and get people to come help them open it all up and make sure there's no contraband or anything in it. And they hated me for that. So I knew about it from that angle just because the mail was increasing, and I would call Lori every day and she would tell me, you know, Eddie Vedder is doing this, or these people in, you know, Seattle are putting together this benefit concert, or, you know, whatever it was, she would tell me about it. And, you know, in one way, yeah, it kind of helps. You're thinking about it when you're on the phone. But in all honesty, the second you hang up that phone, that stuff is happening in a different world. You know, it's so far away that it has almost no impact on the fact that you are fighting every fucking day of your life just to survive. You know, the fact that, you know, people are having like a bake sale in Nebraska or something, theoretically, you know, somewhere in the back of your mind, somehow it gives you a little hope, but you don't think about that in the course of your daily life. In the course of your daily life, all you're doing is trying to survive another day in prison.
And you know, I want to talk about the death penalty too, because everyone knows I'm a very vocal opponent of the death penalty. I don't think it has any place in a civilized society, and most of the world agrees, certainly almost all of the Western world agrees. America is in the very, in the top five of all countries in the world in terms of the number of people we execute, and it's not a good list to be on. And we know now that we execute a lot of innocent people. Mm-hmm. We can't prove the exact numbers, but it's been proven that something like 5% of people on death row, well, have been exonerated, but that doesn't tell us how many are in there still that we haven't been able to get to. Because as you said, it's a time-consuming, difficult, and expensive process.
And there's also estimates now, people who do work in this field, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, organizations like that, they're now estimating that as many as 1 out of every 10 to 25 people on death row are innocent. So think about the fact, say if it's 1 out of every 10, if they told you that 1 out of every 10 planes were going to crash, you wouldn't fly anymore. Everybody would demand that the system be fixed. But since it doesn't affect everybody, you know, it's executions, most people don't have a loved one, a family member, anybody else they know on death row, it sort of slips under the radar.
Yeah, it's a really scary number, and we know some of the ones. I mean, Cameron Todd Willingham, there's a movie being made by a professor at Columbia now about that case in Texas, an innocent guy who was executed for the arson fire that wasn't arson. It was an electrical fire that killed his kids, all three of his kids. What a fate that was. And so we know that there we have a number of names of people who have been executed who we know now were factually innocent, where people have confessed to the crimes that they were convicted of. It's all just very, very troubling and disgusting, and it needs to be abolished. It doesn't accomplish anything. It doesn't help. It doesn't reduce crime. It doesn't scare anybody off of murder, thinking that anyone who's crazy enough to go and do something like that right. is not thinking, well, life in prison, okay, but death penalty, yeah, I'm going to hold off. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I think I'll just go have a V8. Exactly. You know what I mean? Like, it's not happening. So, but for you, the execution date itself, I want to know how you dealt with any of this, right? And then ultimately talk about your exoneration and what you're doing now. So were you aware of, when did you have a date set? How many times was it moved? And how are you even here and not just bouncing off the walls or not sitting in the corner of some bar downtown, you know, with a bottle of scotch?
I think my original execution date was May 5th of either 94 or 95.
Wow.
95, I think. Something like that.
Well, they weren't going to waste any time.
No, they weren't. And I got even closer to it than I should have gotten because the attorneys that I had were so incompetent that they thought I was automatically going to be given a stay. I got within weeks of my execution date before they realized, oh, we actually have to file a stay to keep them from killing this guy. So I could have been killed just by accident, just
negligence.
By sheer incompetence.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
After that, usually what happens is you get an execution date whenever you go from state court to federal court. Like after your state Supreme Court denies your appeal, they set you an execution date. The federal courts then decide whether they're going to hear your case or not. If they do decide, and they don't have to, if they do decide to hear your case, they'll give you a stay of execution, and then they'll hear your case, and it'll go on for a while longer. If they decide we're not even going to hear it, then they're just going to kill you. My brain went dead again.
If they decide not to hear your case, they're going to kill you, right? And here you are back in 95,
right.
Ready to be executed within weeks.
That was it. So what happened is by this time, you know, the documentaries had started coming out. People all over the world had started to hear about the case. You know, there were, can't even count how many TV shows and magazine articles and newspaper articles. And, you know, people had started putting together websites. So, what was happening to us was spreading like crazy. They knew that if our case went from state court to federal court, there was a good chance the federal courts were going to hear it, that they were going to realize what was screwed up, and they were going to throw the whole case out. They didn't want that to happen. So instead of setting me an execution date and allowing me to appeal it to federal court, they just sat on it and held it. In the 18 years and 76 days that I was on death row, I never got to go to federal court. It was still... the swelling of support grew so much that finally the state court decided we're going to have to do something about this because it's making us look really, really bad. It's bringing too much attention. And just like whenever, you know, when I was in the hole and I told you the only thing they cared about in the prison is that people on the outside world are going to realize what they're doing. Same way with judges, prosecutors, all that. The only thing they're concerned with is that people in the outside are going to realize that this case isn't what they're telling people it is. So after that amount of time, they finally decided they said, we're going to have a new evidentiary hearing. And all the evidence is finally going to be heard, all the new DNA evidence. By that point, not only did we have the DNA evidence, but we had all sorts of witnesses that had come forward and said, you know, one woman admitted that the only reason that she tried to implicate us was because the police told her she had committed credit card fraud and they were going to charge her unless she helped them out with this case. So she came forward and admitted to that. There were eyewitnesses who said they saw one of the victim's family members with all three victims within an hour of the time they were murdered. And this was not known at the time that we went to trial. So the prosecutors know all this stuff is about to come out in court. So they start talking with our attorneys and they come up with this deal called an Alford plea. I had never even heard of this thing, made no sense whatsoever. What an Alford plea means is that you are accepting a guilty plea while being allowed to legally maintain your innocence. The only reason this thing exists is so that the state can't be held responsible for what they've done to you. You know, and like I said, I was dying physically, you know, health-wise. I knew that if I didn't take this deal one way or another, I was never going to live to see the outside of those walls. You know, the prosecutor came to us and pretty much said, yeah, you'll win this case if you go to federal court, but we can draw this out for another 5 years, another 10 years. Every time the judge sets a date, we can ask for an extension. Wow. We can appeal any decisions made, or you can accept this deal and go home tomorrow, literally tomorrow. But you can sign these papers and walk out of this prison.
But there was another catch, which is that they insisted that all three guys do it, right?
Exactly.
And they had an amazing amount of leverage there too, because now it goes back to your friend, Jason Baldwin, right?
Exactly.
And Jason was ready to fight the case, but he wanted to be declared innocent after everything he had been through. But they held a little bit of a huge hammer, which was that they made it known to him that if he decided he wanted to fight the case, they were going to execute you.
Mm-hmm.
And that friendship that you guys had had from when you were teenagers, now here it is 18 years later. And it's really interesting, right? That one woman that you spoke about, who also changed her story over time, she got to keep her credit cards while sentencing you to death.
Yep.
That's really, let's face it, right? That was the deal. She made, she somewhere in her head, she decided that was a good deal. Now, maybe she thought you really were guilty and they probably convinced her of that. Let's hope that was really the case. But one way or another, for the sake of a couple of credit cards, and the, you know, the difficulties it would have caused her if that, you know, went to court, whatever, she was more than willing to roll over on you and have an innocent guy go to his death. But so Jason now had really a Sophie's choice, right? He had to accept this Alford plea, allow the state to force him to live his life as a convicted felon, and never be able to sue for compensation. There's the added element of the fact that when Alford pleas are given and accepted, typically it means that they won't go reopen the case because as far as they're concerned, it's still closed. So there's no justice for the kids. There's no justice for their families. But it was a convenient thing. It allowed a certain number of people to save face and allowed you to go home.
Yep.
So you took the Alford plea. I think anybody in your situation would have. And when the alternative was death, it's a pretty easy decision to make. And how long after you took that did you get to go home?
About a week later.
What the hell was that like? I mean,
it was honestly, it was kind of horrendous because I didn't know that I was going to get out until the night before I got out. The night before I got out, they came and got me and took me to the county jail. And I knew then they wouldn't be going through this amount of trouble because the county jail was like several hours away from the prison. So I knew they wouldn't be going through this amount of trouble, you know, taking me several hours away from the prison unless I am getting out. So I knew there was a chance I might get out, but I didn't know I was going to. So in that week, I did not sleep. I did not eat. I began at that point edging towards a nervous breakdown. The day we walked out of prison, I did not have one single penny of money in my pocket. I didn't have so much as a suit of clothes to change into. I had nowhere to go. I had nothing. We didn't think of stuff like that whenever I was in prison. We're just thinking, keep these people from killing me, go home. That's the finish line. That's it. So that's what we had always been working towards. We didn't realize what was going to happen whenever I walked out of those gates. Keep in mind that not only had I been in prison for almost 20 years by that point, I had spent almost the last decade of that in solitary confinement. So I went from a decade of solitary confinement to being out on the streets of Manhattan literally overnight, and it shattered me psychologically. I can't remember the first 2 years that I was out of prison. If you put together everything I can remember within the first 2 years that I walked out, it may equal a couple hours. It destroyed me in every way that it possibly could. We weren't counting on any of that. I had two nervous breakdowns due to not only that, but also once we're out, you know, you're constantly, you've got the media coming at you, asking you every day all these questions about being in prison, about the case, all this. So you get to the point where you're thinking, why the fuck did I even get out? I'm not even out of prison. You know, I'm out here, but it's the only thing people are asking me about. It's the only thing people are talking to me about. You know, random people walk up to you on the street and start talking about the case. So it's not even like you're out of prison anymore. It's just like the prison is in your head all the time. You know, you may be, it was like when I was in prison, at least I could have a mental and emotional life separate from the prison. Entire days, weeks, months would go by when I wouldn't even think about the fact that I was in prison because I was so busy trying to build a life for myself. When I got out, it almost felt like I was having to think more about prison than when I was in. And it destroyed me in every way that it possibly could.
But there's a real silver lining here, right? And that silver lining's sitting only a few feet away from us right now.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you meet Lori? And I can see when you two are together, it's like there's like an orb. You're like a glowing orb. I think you can probably see it from the space station. So how did you meet her, and what has that meant to you?
Lori was one of the very first people who saw the first documentary back in 1996, whenever it came out. She was living in New York at the time. She was a landscape architect. And she used to get, before it came out on HBO, they had like several small screenings and like, you know, art house type theaters. And she got tickets to one of those, went and saw the movie and said she couldn't stop thinking about it. And, you know, just like I was saying a while ago about how much letters mean to people inside the prison, she sat down and wrote me a letter. And this was back, you know, before the internet was everywhere and you could find anything in the world just by Googling it in 3 seconds. You know, she had to go through a lot of effort and trouble just to get the address of the prison, just to find out where I even was. Whenever I got the very first letter from her, the minute I opened it, I knew that this was someone unlike anyone else that I'd ever known. And it kind of goes back to what you were just saying about the orb. I, honest to God, felt like as long as we were together, as long as she was looking after me, as long as she was in my life and working on this case, from that moment on, I honestly felt like these people cannot hurt me anymore. I'm safe. And it was true. As long as she was in my life, I mean, yeah, there was a lot of bad stuff in prison, but it was like it never got to worst case scenario. Somehow or another, things would always turn around. Things would always work out. It was like we had divine intervention on our side in a lot of ways. Lori ended up doing more work on my case than the attorneys, private investigators, and everybody else put together. After they did the DNA testing, she's the one out there digging through people's garbage to find cigarette butts to try to match the DNA to. She was the one out there, you know, doing the fundraising. She was doing everything she could to keep people from forgetting about this case.
Wow. I mean, for a landscape architect, she's a damn good investigator, publicist, advocate. And it's just, I've just a ton of respect and admiration for you, Lori. And I can say that because you're sitting here and everything that you've done and everything that you are. So you're together now, you're here at the Church of Rock and Roll, at opening weekend, which I'm so, like I said, so grateful to both of you for coming. And what's this experience been like for you?
It's been actually pretty amazing. You know, I think I've only started to come out of shock and trauma and become happy and everything else probably within the last 2 years. We've been out for about 7 years now. So probably within the past 2 years is whenever the real actual healing started. And I started being able to focus on things that I wanted to focus on, building a life. And, you know, one of those things was doing what we did here today or last night, like with the commitment ceremonies and being able to talk to people about, you know, things that mean something to me personally and develop real relationships with people based on things other than just the case. Last night, I would have people like 21-year-old kids who have no idea who the hell I even am. Don't care. They were coming to the commitment ceremonies, wanting to do the commitments. Not because it was me, but because they love each other, they want to be part of it, whatever it is. Stuff like that. That is what's rewarding. That's what I love doing. You know, things that are real.
Yeah, and I had the opportunity to see parts of some of the ceremonies and also to talk to some of the people who participated in them. And the stories are beautiful. I mean, people who were on the verge of breaking up after 12 years of marriage and came, I think they came because you were you and they wanted to have that, they wanted to get some of your special brand of magic. And now they're, you know, now they're recommitted to each other and, and other people who found some new level to go to in whatever relationship they're in. And you're giving them their certificates and the embossing on the Church of Rock and Roll logo. And I mean, for me, it's just an unbelievable feeling to know that we're having that kind of a positive impact on them, on you because of them, and then on everyone who's around. Sitting in the pews because we have pews outside and we have the what do you call that, the when people do the fingers, the two fingers up in the air, the rock and roll sort of the horns. We have those in neon out by the, so I'm trying to give people a visual, and we're going to be taking this on the road and hopefully bringing it to other cities near you, whoever you are, wherever you're listening. And I'm really excited about that, and I think we're just going to do a lot of really, really great stuff together. And so my favorite part of the podcast, everyone, and we're now in our seventh season, is when I get to stop talking entirely and just turn the mic over to you and get your final thoughts on anything you want to talk about, whether it's how people can get involved or what people, anything at all. I mean, you can talk about the weather if you want. So before I do that, I want to say again that I appreciate you being here and sharing your thoughts and your wisdom and your courage and your story, because I know it's not easy, with our audience and with everyone in the room here at the Church of Rock and Roll. So, and then I'm going to turn it over to you for final thoughts, and then we're all going to meditate under your guidance, which I'm super excited about. So
actually what I usually do instead of, you know, I always tell people the reason I do stuff like this is not to force everyone to hear me ramble on like a jackass. I'm here to talk about whatever people want to talk about. You know, that's the reason I'm here, is because, and that's the reason everybody else is here. I'm sure, you know, when people hear these stories, they probably have things that come to mind that they wonder about that maybe we didn't touch on or whatever it is. So I usually just like to give people the opportunity, if there was anybody that had a question or anything out of everything we just talked about that you'd like to know the answer to or hear more about or anything else, I'm willing to, you know, whether it's prison life, whether it's the case, whether it's life after, whatever the hell it is you want to know about, if there's any question you have, I'm open to it.
Oh, well, this is a new thing. Since we usually record in the studio without an audience, now we have that opportunity. So we will open it up for just a few questions, because then we do want to get to the meditation. Does anybody have a question for Damien?
Damien, thank you for sharing your story with us. It's flabbergasting to hear that all of that actually happened to you and you had to live through it. Through all of your darkest hours, how did you find the strength to fight through that?
I think for those at home who might not be able to hear the question, he asked, even before Lori found me, before she started taking on the case, like during my darkest hours, what it was that allowed me to keep surviving on a daily basis in prison. And really what it comes down to, and this is incredibly important, you know, keep in mind, they say that your average person in prison, even when you take, you know, we're talking about the guy in our case that gave the confession that only had an IQ of 70 to 72. Even when you take that out of the equation, the average IQ of the person in prison is only about 85. So that's still well below, you know, average IQ level. So a lot of people aren't capable of even doing this, which is why it's so important that help come from the outside world. But what it comes down to is finding something to focus on other than the prison. You know, I would see guys in there on a daily basis that didn't have people in the outside world, that weren't capable of like constructing a routine or anything else to give them something to focus on. So their full attention was taken up by the fact that they were on death row. They're waiting to be executed. And you see them snap all the time. You know, I would see things like one day this guy, he just starts screaming and beating on the walls of his cell with both fists until both of his fists are just busted and bloody. They take him, he's screaming that the devil is in his cell. All they do, they take him out, wrap his hands up, and throw him back in his cell. People go insane because they are focused on the prison all the time. So really what I did was I had to find ways to give myself a life outside of that environment. And for me, a lot of it was, you know, like we were talking about earlier, reading. At one point, you know, like I said, also, I only had a ninth grade education. So after Lori especially came into my life, I started hearing about all these things that I didn't have within my frame of reference, you know, like Camus and Dickens and Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and all these sorts of things. So I decided, I want to know what the hell people are even talking about whenever they're talking about these things. So I started devouring books that I honestly didn't even really have a great deal of interest in. You know, even things like the works of Freud and Jung and things like that, just because I wanted to know what it was about. I did eventually reach a point where I thought, none of this stuff is really feeding me in any substantial way. You know, I'm taking in a lot of abstract knowledge and concepts and stories and writing styles and things like this, but it doesn't make me happy in any way. So one day, after we had filled up an entire storage facility with books, I stopped and went back to the things that meant something to me. So a lot of it for me was reading a lot, working out a lot, meditation a lot. You know, the heart and soul of my life when I was in prison, and even now that I'm out of prison, was ceremonial magic. By the time I got out of prison, I was doing meditation and energy work for up to 8 hours a day. And part of what destroyed me whenever I got out, you know, the psychological devastation, for some reason, when I walked out of prison, I could not read anymore. Like, I would try to read a page, and I would read the same page over and over and over, and I couldn't retain what I had just read when I got to the bottom of the page. I couldn't watch TV shows. Like I said, I didn't even have facial recognition. So I would go to dinner with people, meet them 2 days later, and not be able to even remember who they were. So that screwed me up a lot. But really what it came down to in prison, what allowed me to survive, was not thinking about prison. Coming up with something else to focus on other than the horror that was going on around me.
Damien, I love your optimism and your lust for life. I would love to know what your idea of a perfect day is now. What does that look like?
A perfect day is one when I live in New York, up in Harlem. A perfect day to me is a day when I don't have to get on the subway, when I don't have to walk out my front door at all. I get up in the morning, I start going through my daily meditations, daily energy work, take a break. And this may sound crazy, but I actually take pleasure in cleaning the house. That's but really one of the things that also helped me whenever I first got out was doing laundry. I had never done laundry in my life, but I would go into the laundry room where the washer and dryer was. And something about that was like being in a rocking chair to me. It calmed and soothed my nerves. So really a perfect day to me. I don't leave my apartment. I don't get on the subway. I'm back up now. Like I said, you know, it shattered me. Like, I couldn't even read. I also couldn't do magic. I couldn't meditate. I couldn't do anything. I went from 8 hours a day to not even being able to do 8 minutes a day. So I've gradually built up over time until now I'm back up. Some days I can do on a really good day between 5 and 7 hours. Wow. So that's a perfect day to me. Doing that, ordering pizza, and playing with my cats.
I think we have time for one more question.
I was just wondering if you are aware of any groups that are fighting for justice for the three boys. Do you think the real killer will ever come to light?
I think, honestly, I do. I think it will come to light. But, you know, like I was saying earlier about the politics of everything involved, I honestly think before that happens, a lot of the people who have a vested interest in keeping this covered up, who, you know, to preserve their jobs, can't let the truth come out. I think a lot of those people will either have to retire or move on or whatever it is. And new people who don't have a vested interest in this will have to come on board, who will actually look at the evidence, who will actually hear the case. So, yeah, I do think one day eventually something will happen. Honestly, I don't keep up with the case. So I don't know of any organization. The only organization I know of, two legal organizations. One is the Innocence Project, which Jason is on, and the other one is Proclaim Justice, which Jason Baldwin is on. And the only reason I know about those two is because of, you know, personal relationships. I don't keep up with to me, you know, like I was just describing a perfect day, to me a hellish day would be a day when I had to read like a court brief or a legal brief or, you know, watch a true crime show or any of that sort of thing. So those are honestly the only two organizations that I know anything about at all.
I'm really glad you asked that question. That was a great question. So anyway, now I just want to say again, this has been an awesome experience for me. Thank you everyone for being here at the Church of Rock and Roll. And thank you, Damien, for everything you're doing and for being a guest on Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's fucking meditate.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.